KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It kind of feels like we're back in that early, you know, 2020 era when COVID was just starting to hit and nobody quite knew what was happening.
With the White House changing its messaging on tariffs day by day, the car market is getting confused.
It's Thursday, April 10th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, how cuts at federal health agencies are slowing down recovery efforts after Hurricane Helene.
I feel like I've let down the community. I let down the health department. I let down North Carolina itself.
Also, as President Trump targets certain law firms, the ripple effects are extending well beyond the boardrooms of big law.
And a Korean War hero from Kansas moves one step closer to canonization as a saint.
We've had kids as far as South Korea come to be baptized in our baptismal font.
Those stories and more after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Supreme Court has ruled the Trump administration must take steps to return Kilmar Armando Obrego Garcia to the U.S. Obrego Garcia is a Maryland man who was wrongly deported to a detention center in El Salvador. More from NPR's Jasmine Garst.
Back in March, Kilmar Armando Obrego Garcia was arrested by immigration officials and sent to a notorious detention center in El Salvador alongside several hundred other men accused of being Venezuelan gang members. Obrego Garcia is in the U.S. with legal protection and is married to a U.S. citizen. His lawyers say he has no gang affiliation or criminal record in any country. The government has acknowledged his detention and deportation was an administrative error. The Supreme Court decision does not directly order the U.S. government to return Obrego Garcia, but rather directs the Trump administration to, quote, facilitate and effectuate the return of the migrant and share what steps it is taking to do so. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
House Republicans have narrowly approved a major priority for President Trump today, a budget resolution. It unlocks the process Republicans need to enact much of Trump's domestic policy agenda. NPR's Barbara Spahn explains two Republicans voted against the measure.
The passage comes after the initial vote was delayed because of a critical mass of opposition from within the House Republican Conference. More than a dozen members had expressed concerns that the measure before them didn't do enough to address the deficit. Congressional leadership huddled with members overnight and continued negotiations into the morning. Now that the budget blueprint has been adopted by the House and the Senate, Republicans in both chambers will begin the heavy lift of writing and getting support for a multi-trillion-dollar package that would extend the 2017 tax cuts and adjust military, energy, and border spending. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, the Capitol.
Florida's attorney general says the state is charging Ryan Ruth with attempted first-degree murder for his alleged attempt on President Trump's life last year. NPR's Greg Allen reports Ruth is in federal custody waiting trial on several charges.
Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer says the state is also charging Ruth with terrorism for his alleged assassination attempt in September in West Palm Beach, where Trump was golfing. A person identified as Ruth fled the scene after he was spotted and fired on by a member of Trump's Secret Service detail. Uthmeyer says the state charges come after months of what he called stonewalling by the Biden administration and credits cooperation with Trump's Attorney General Pam Bondi and FBI Director Kash Patel. Florida's case against Ruth won't proceed until he stands trial on federal charges. He's scheduled to be in court next week for a hearing involving evidence that will be presented in that case. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed down 1,000 points plus today. The Nasdaq fell 777 points. You're listening to NPR. The death toll continues to rise in the Dominican Republic following the collapse of the roof of a nightclub there earlier this week. Officials now say at least 221 people were killed. Dozens more were hurt. Collapse of the cement roof at the Jet Set Club in Santo Domingo took place early Tuesday. 189 people were pulled alive from the rubble. Doctors say some of those who were hospitalized remain in critical condition. Two men could go to prison for vandalizing natural rock formations in Nevada. NPR's Kristen Wright reports the Red Rock formations are federally protected.
Video showed two men pushing the iconic Red Rock sandstone formations off a cliff at the Lake Mead Recreational Area, toppling them onto a trail just outside of Las Vegas last year. The iconic rocks were formed from desert dunes that are 140 million years old, according to the National Park Service. After a two-day trial, a jury found Wyatt Fain and Peyton Cosper guilty of purposely destroying government property. They could face up to a year in prison and possibly a $100,000 fine. Their sentencing is in July. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
Two-story names in the luxury goods market have agreed to tie the knot. Prada says it will buy rival Versace in a deal that values the Italian fashion house at $1.4 billion. Founded in 1978 by the late Gianni Versace, it's been owned by Capri Holdings since 2018. Capri Holdings paid $2 billion for the brand, but it's been struggling to position it. It is known for its sexy silhouettes and loud patterns. Crude oil futures prices lost ground today. Oil down 3.3% to $63.33 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Yesterday, I introduced one of our reporters with the line that President Trump is backtracking, sort of, in his trade war. That sort of is doing a lot of work. Because even after yesterday's announcement of a pause in some tariffs, today there are still a lot of tariffs in place.
The tariff rate on Chinese products is still well over 100%. There are still tariffs for certain goods from Canada and Mexico. There's still a tariff on steel and aluminum imports. And there's still a baseline tariff of 10% on imports from nearly every country on Earth.
The Yale Budget Lab says the best way to think of this is from the perspective of the consumer, and they calculate that U.S. consumers will still face the highest overall tariff rate since 1904. The import taxes will cost the average household somewhere between $2,600 and $4,400 in increased prices. And economists made those calculations before the White House clarified today that the tariff on China wasn't just 125%, as Trump announced yesterday, it was actually a total of 145%.
So, say you're trying to buy a car. 25% tariffs are still in place on imported cars and car parts. That could send prices up in coming months on both new and used cars. Now, some people are hurrying up to make a purchase at pre-tariff prices. Others plan to drive their current cars into the ground. NPR's Camila Domonoski has our report.
Kira Ney, a children's librarian in Ohio, would like to have a second child in the next few years, and she figured she'd eventually need to swap out her family's 2008 Toyota for something bigger.
A car that could transport both our children and also our dog in one vehicle would be really ideal.
She and her husband were hoping to wait until next year to make that big purchase.
But with the tariffs and so much of the uncertainty about that, we just decided that we couldn't wait any longer.
They ran out and bought an SUV in late March, and they weren't the only ones.
The dealership was packed.
But there are also lots of drivers like Jennifer Jarvis, a pharmacist in Michigan. She, too, was hoping to get a newer SUV soon, but instead, she and her husband replaced the transmission in their old minivan and plan to drive it another 100,000 miles.
The idea of trying to buy a car in this market and the tariffs and everything, I mean, we're going to be driving this probably until it needs either another transmission or it falls off the road.
The tariffs keep changing. Yesterday, President Trump paused many tariffs, but the ones important to the auto industry remain, like tariffs on cars and parts and the metals that go into them. add it up and it's a weird time for car sales. But the auto industry has dealt with weird before, says Scott Cunas, whose dealership group is based in Wisconsin.
It kind of feels like we're back in that early, you know, 2020 era when COVID was just starting to hit and nobody quite knew what was happening.
For now, demand is up, and there are good deals on new cars where price hikes aren't here yet, and dealers have weeks' worth of vehicles on lots.
All the vehicles that are currently on the ground or in port are not affected by tariffs. So we do have somewhat of a supply as this kind of works itself out.
If the tariffs stick, analysts say car prices could go up by thousands of dollars. Cunas says his business can adapt, but this will make it harder to buy a car on a budget.
I think one thing that nobody's really thinking about or talking about is the used car market.
Cunas sells used cars too, and tariffs will indirectly drive up those prices. In fact, they have already. Angelica De Leon in Connecticut is feeling that. When she was unemployed during the COVID pandemic, her car was repossessed. Since then, she's been relying on Uber and friends.
Connecticut is very, like, if you don't have a car, it's kind of hard to get around.
After saving up for 2 years and getting a full-time admin job, she could buy a car in the $10,000 range, if she can find a reliable option.
So recently, I'm looking at the prices, and I noticed that they shot up.
Vehicles out of her price range just got further out of reach. She asks a question.
When you're making, you know, the minimum, and you do need a car, how do you set yourself up?
That's already a problem for people across the country, and the tariff chaos is only making it worse. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Since his return to office, President Trump has issued a series of executive orders against law firms that he accuses of unethical actions. It's all part of Trump's campaign of vengeance against his perceived political enemies. Some of the targeted law firms have fought back, others have cut deals, and the ripple effects of this legal fight are already being felt beyond the boardrooms of big law. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas reports.
In the Oval Office late last month, President Trump announced that the prominent law firm Skadden Arps had reached a deal with his administration. The agreement headed off a possible executive order similar to the ones Trump has issued against other law firms. Under the agreement, Trump said, Skadden would, among other things, provide $100 million in free legal work to causes supported by both the Trump administration and the firm.
We appreciate Skadden's coming to the table. As you know, other law firms have likewise settled the case, and it's a shame what's gone on.
What has gone on, in Trump's telling, is that major law firms have weaponized the justice system and taken actions that undermine America. Part of that, he's argued, is through the firm's pro bono work on what he calls destructive causes, which boils down to the firms representing clients at odds with Trump's own views on everything from the environment and civil rights to immigration and voting. Three other law firms also have struck deals with Trump to avoid punishment.
I've never seen an administration target firms for, their case selections, for the clients they select.
Lourdes Rosado is the president and general counsel of Latino Justice Pearl Def, a New York-based civil rights nonprofit.
And it really does set a very dangerous precedent of political interference in the legal profession.
More than 170 lawsuits have been filed in federal court so far challenging Trump administration policies, frustrating the president and slowing his agenda. In many of those cases, major law firms are working alongside advocacy groups like Rosado's, adding resources and legal firepower.
The administration's attacks on big law firms really create a climate of fear that could deter firms from taking on these very politically sensitive, pro bono cases that are challenging unconstitutional actions right now.
NPR spoke with attorneys at a half dozen organizations that regularly team up with big law firms providing pro bono assistance to challenge government actions or policies. All of them say they have deep concerns about law firms pulling back from pro bono work. Some say it's already happening.
Increasingly, I'm hearing about political considerations being an issue in firms deciding whether they're going to be able to assist.
Dustin Reinders is the legal director of the Texas Civil Rights Project.
But I have been turned down on some recent requests where people have expressed concern about political ramifications, about being involved in immigrant rights work in this time, about being involved in civil rights, voting rights cases, in challenges against the administration.
The pro bono assistance law firms provide can vary from case to case, but it generally includes things like providing attorneys to conduct legal research or providing financial backing to pay for travel, experts, and court costs. For many organizations, that help is vital.
Without the assistance of those extra attorneys, those extra minds, those extra resources, we're able to bring fewer cases. We're able to put less resources in the cases we bring, which can also impact your ultimate likelihood of success.
In other words, if law firms pull back on pro bono work, there likely will be fewer challenges to potentially unconstitutional actions by the government down the road. If that happens, it's not one case or one cause that suffers, says Jennifer Levi from the legal rights organization GLAAD Law.
Like, this isn't just about progressive causes or any particular political stance. This is ultimately about whether the legal system can function the way that it's supposed to.
Levi takes heart from the fact that some law firms are fighting back. Three firms targeted by Trump have sued in federal court. In all three lawsuits, judges have temporarily blocked enforcement of the executive order's punitive measures. Levi says that the legal profession doesn't push back now. The whole idea of equal justice and the justice system is vulnerable. And that, she adds, is something the legal profession can't compromise on. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
By the late 1970s, Jeff Bridges was already a movie star. But on the side, he kept alive one of his original passions, music. He and a group of old high school buddies would meet up regularly at a friend's place and just jam.
It was just a free-form jam. He had a saxophone just hanging from the rafters by a piano string. And anybody could go up and just, wail on it.
Eventually, they decided to record some of those songs.
We got a little space and, got a funky one of those TIAC four-track tape recorders. And we went to town.
And decades later, Bridges found the cassette tape. And now he is releasing it as an album called Slow Magic. Tune in tomorrow to hear my conversation with Jeff Bridges about this musical time capsule from his early days in Hollywood.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Earlier this year, Pope Francis named Father Emil Capon venerable. That decree brings the Catholic priest and Korean War hero from Kansas one step closer to canonization as a saint. That road is long, but it could mean big changes for his small hometown. Rose Conlin of member station KMUW has this story.
Capon's story starts in the small Kansas farm town of Pilsen. Its population?
Ooh, maybe 40-something? I don't know. Dogs and cats count?
That's Melissa Stuklik, a tour guide at the Chaplain Capon Museum in town. She takes visitors through the rectory where Capon lived as a young priest, past photos from his time as an army chaplain. In 2013, President Barack Obama awarded Capon a Medal of Honor for his bravery during the Korean War.
An American soldier who didn't fire a gun, but who wielded the mightiest weapon of all. A love for his brothers so pure that he was willing to die so that they might live.
Capon dragged injured soldiers to safety on the battlefield. And as enemy forces closed in, he allowed himself to be captured so he could continue to care for his men. He prayed not only for his fellow prisoners of war, but also for the guards who held them captive. Capon died in a Korean prison camp in 1951 at age 35. Stuklik tells the Pilsen tour that the church next door houses two items that would be considered second-class relics if, or as she says, when Capon becomes a saint.
One of them is the crucifix that Father carried as an altar server, and the other one would be the baptismal font that Father was baptized in. And we've had kids as far as South Korea come to be baptized in our baptismal font.
Visitor numbers have picked up here since Capon was named venerable, but it's nothing compared to what could happen later. The relics of saints can draw tens of thousands of pilgrims to holy places each year, and that could mean big changes for Pilsen, which has no post office, gas station, or stoplight.
Pilsen would probably get bigger. I would think it would be a lot of bed and breakfast popping up all over the place. We joke about the McDonald's and the Hyatt.
Stuklik says there's a lot for Pilsen to gain and maybe lose.
Because right now, if you sat outside on our front porch, you would hear the quiet and the peacefulness. And we'd want to keep some of that.
But sainthood and a busier Pilsen could be decades away. The Vatican will investigate potential miracles attributed to Capon's intercession from heaven. Catholics believe saints can bring prayers to God on their behalf. Scott Carter is the coordinator for Capon's cause for sainthood. He says one confirmed miracle is needed for the next step to canonization, beatification.
We'll have to, you know, kind of shore up our paperwork. We'll kind of have to jump back in line over in Rome. So could be as early as a handful of years. Maybe it's a decade. I'm hoping it's not longer than that.
One potential miracle involves Chase Keir, a former college athlete who nearly died in a pole vaulting accident 16 years ago. He was 14 feet in the air when he lost control.
I went over the backside of the landing pad and hit my head on the track, and I fractured my skull from ear to ear across the front.
Doctors told his mom, Paula, that they had to remove part of his skull.
They told us, you know, that he has a better chance of dying on the table than living through the surgery.
But Chase did live through the surgery. Then he started walking, then talking. He graduated college and got a job, got married, had kids. Paula says he's defied every doctor's expectations.
They have all said they can't explain it, that it is a miracle.
Through it all, his family and church community prayed. One prayer in particular was a constant.
Father Capon, I ask your intercession, not only for these needs which I mention now, Chase, the healing of Chase Keir, but that I too may follow through your example of service to God and my neighbor.
For NPR News, I'm Rose Conlin in Pilsen, Kansas.
The Trump administration's deep, sudden cuts at federal health agencies last week slammed the brakes on various projects. One of them was a recovery effort in western North Carolina, hard hit by Hurricane Helene last September. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
In and around Asheville, North Carolina, visible signs of the hurricane 6 months ago remain. Rusted debris in yards of ruined homes. But Helene, a federal disaster worker who coincidentally goes by the same name as the storm, also worries about the community's invisible problems, like mold and the financial and mental health after effects.
That 6 month mark is a really critical time.
Until April 1st, Helene worked at the National Center for Environmental Health at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Her team parachutes in after storms, wildfires, or toxic spills to assess where to put emergency resources. The Tuesday she was terminated, Helene and some 55 others, including county and state workers, were set to go door to door in Asheville's Buncombe County, surveying 210 households about enduring challenges, from food insecurity to unsafe drinking water. She and others were en route or already on site when she had to let them all know they had to abort mission.
It was really one of the hardest phone calls I've ever had to do in my career.
Helene did not want to use her full name because she's on administrative leave and fears retaliation. She says she feels heartbroken.
I feel like I just let down the community. I let down the health department. I let down North Carolina itself. I lost my job, but people have lost so much to these disasters, and we're not out there trying to help them. We were really these boots on the ground, finding out what the community itself needed.
Ellis Matheson was on the other end of one of Helene's calls that morning.
I was really, really disappointed.
Matheson is Buncombe County's public health director.
We had publicized this to the community. They knew that we were going to be coming. So we had to notify the public that we would not be coming.
Matheson thought about the missed opportunity.
There would have been human-to-human interaction, and people could ask questions, say what resources they need, and right there in the moment, we could connect them with those resources.
Matheson says they plan to regroup, but without the CDC's help, her county team could not do the door-to-door survey as planned.
That expertise to help us with the analysis and develop a report was really vital. That subject matter expertise, we really rely on that.
That's one reason why CDC exists.
That's Zach Moore, an epidemiologist with North Carolina's Department of Health. He says state departments like his lack both resources and experience that a federal team develops by dealing with various disasters across the country.
The subject matter expertise that exists at CDC, we can't and really shouldn't replicate in every state across the country.
Moore says he has a lot of public health concerns across his state right now.
Oh gosh, measles, hurricanes, flu, there's a lot of things.
He worries that hollowing out the CDC's Environmental Health Division, along with other deep cuts to staff and funding, will leave them less prepared to face it all.
So having them instantly disbanded is going to leave a big gap.
The CDC did not respond to requests seeking comment. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
A new streaming series focuses on a hedge fund manager who loses his job and turns to robbing his rich friends. It's also about how wealth can disappear in an instant.
If all of this stuff is so ephemeral, then why do we ascribe so much meaning to it? Does it define us?
Actor John Hamm on his new show, Your Friends and Neighbors, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. We'll be right back.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Across the U.S., business owners are trying to make sense of President Trump's tariffs.
Everyone is just in a holding pattern.
We're going to have to scale back a lot of innovation.
We just noticed our first invoice that had a tariff line on it.
I have hopes that tariffs will help us, but that can't be the end game.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. One day after President Trump announced a 90-day pause on tariffs for most countries, financial markets took another nosedive today as the president upped his tariffs on China, a major U.S. trading partner, to a whopping 145%. Stocks gave back most of their historic rebound from yesterday as Trump's trade war with China continues to threaten the economy.
We think we're in very good shape. We think we're doing very well. Again, there'll be a transition cost and transition problems, but in the end, it's going to be a beautiful thing.
China has placed tariffs of 84% on imports from the U.S., including chicken, pork, soybeans, and beef, while tariffs on Chinese imports could raise the cost for U.S. consumers on everything from clothing to computer chips and electric vehicle batteries. On Capitol Hill, the House passed legislation today that will require showing proof of citizenship in person to register to vote in federal elections. NPR's Jude Jaffe Block reports it's a GOP priority that's fiercely opposed by voting rights advocates.
The bill was expected to pass in the House. Supporters say the SAVE Act is needed to ensure only American citizens vote in American elections, though cases of non-citizen voting have been rare. But voting rights advocates and Democrats say the bill could disenfranchise tens of millions of voters and create barriers for others, including married women who don't have an ID that matches the name on their birth certificate. The bill would upend how Americans register to vote, since it requires showing proof of citizenship documents in person. It goes to the Senate next, where it will need bipartisan support to pass. Jude Jaffe Block, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks hit another free fall today. The tech-heavy Nasdaq lost more than 700 points, down more than 4%. This is NPR. Lightning strikes kill millions of trees every year, but researchers say some tropical trees are able to thrive after being hit. NPR's Bill Chappell has more on why.
Scientists say that in Panama's forests, lightning helps some large trees by zapping parasitic vines and rival trees that can't handle the power. Forest ecologist Evan Gora says he and other authors of the recent study were surprised trees can thrive after being hit with around 30,000 amps of current. People commenting on it also find some meaning in that.
We've had a couple people specifically reference, you know, it's a stressful time right now, and nice to have an analogy of, you know, surviving the seemingly unsurvivable.
The researchers want to learn more about how the trees conduct electricity and live hundreds of years after being struck by lightning. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
Authorities say six people, including a family of five visiting from Spain, died this afternoon in a helicopter crash in the Hudson River in New York City. The pilot, along with two adults and three children, were killed. That helicopter broke apart in midair and crashed upside down in the river between New York and New Jersey. An investigation into the cause is underway. If you recall, back in 2018, a charter helicopter offering open-door flights went down in New York's East River, killing five people. You are listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. It's pretty rare for one person to do one thing that affects nearly every business in the United States. But that's the power of the presidency and the new tariffs that took effect this week.
Everyone is just in a holding pattern.
We're going to have to scale back a lot of innovation.
We just noticed our first invoice that had a tariff line on it.
I have hopes that tariffs will help us, but that can't be the end game.
Over the last few days, as the tariffs have gone up and down, I've been talking to Americans who run different kinds of businesses. Even though their companies don't have much in common, all of them are doing the same thing right now, trying to figure out what's going on and how to respond. Take Yair Reiner. He invented a popular kitchen gadget, a splatter guard called Frywall. It was a hit on Shark Tank back in 2018.
Frywall keeps the sizzle in the pan and the splatter off of you and your stovetop.
He priced out what it would cost to produce his invention in the U.S. and figured to turn a profit, he would have to sell a made-in-the-USA Frywall for about $80.
You know, it's really hard to sell a splatter guard for that much money.
Even the best splatter guard in the world is not going to sell for $80.
Precisely. It is the best splatter guard in the world, but, you know, splatter just is not as important as other things.
So he makes it in China, which allows him to sell it for about $25. And he says that money gets spread around to many parts of the U.S. economy.
It goes to the U.S. Postal Service, which provides my quote-unquote free shipping. If I sell on Amazon, it goes to Amazon, who has to pay its warehouse workers. I also have to pay my patent attorney so that my patent is protected and I can't get ripped off. It has to go to PR, it has to go to marketing. It has to go to the software firms that I use to, you know, operate and run my business.
But now President Trump has put a 145% tariff on goods from China. At least that's the number as we record this midday Thursday. It's been a moving target.
I've worked hard to have a stable price on my product for almost 10 years. And now I'm looking at a situation where I'm going to have to raise it by 20, maybe 25%, maybe more. I'm not sure if I still have a market at that point. And I don't know if I still have a business.
And so if that's going to be the case for the foreseeable future, for the next 4 years, where does that leave you?
It leaves me making plans from week to week, which is not the way that they teach you to run a business, either at your parents' table or in business school.
The Trump administration says tariffs on imports are meant to help American manufacturers, like Lisa Winton.
I'm a small manufacturer in Georgia, and I produce machinery.
Winton Machine Company makes metal parts that go into everything from refrigerators to lawn chairs, and most of the company's supply chain is in the U.S. But some of Lisa Winton's distributors get their parts from China, and they've started passing along the cost of tariffs to her.
So I have to purchase, I have to place my order, and then when I place my order, they'll let me know what my tariff fee is.
Oh, so you might say, I've got $500 to spend on this, or $5,000, or whatever. And then when the bill comes in, you see tacked on to it is a tariff fee that could put this way outside of your budget. You just don't know.
I don't know. It's uncertainty. And, you know, with uncertainty also goes, we ship all over the world. So if there's additional tariffs put on my machinery to export, that's going to be very painful.
Have you heard from anyone who has said, you know what, I was going to buy from China, but given the situation with the tariffs, I think I would rather buy from Winton Machine instead? Like, is this going to help you in that respect?
We do benefit from manufacturers that say, I want to buy American-made machinery. There's just so much unknown right now, and I think that's the most difficult thing to make decisions for your company financially when you just don't know all the pieces of the puzzle.
I hear a lot of caution in your voice, but I can't quite tell whether you're cautiously optimistic or cautiously pessimistic right now.
I think the glass is half full, and I've taken a few sips.
Some businesses have to worry about tariffs on one country. Ethan Frisch has to worry about tariffs on 30 different countries.
We work with producers in Vietnam, in Sri Lanka, in Tanzania, in Guatemala, in Afghanistan, and Turkey.
He's co-founder and co-CEO of a spice company called Burlap and Barrel. They've spent years developing relationships with small farmers. Yesterday, Trump paused global tariffs at 10% for 90 days on every country but China. But 10% is still a price hike, and nobody knows what'll happen 3 months from now.
We can't just switch our supplier from Vietnam to another country with a lower tariff rate, because that variety of cinnamon simply doesn't grow anywhere else.
Burlap and Barrel has decided that even with these tariffs, they won't charge customers more or pay farmers less.
We're going to make less money ourselves. That's the bottom line. At the end of the day, we're going to have to scale back a lot of innovation. We launch about 50 new products every year. We had an advent calendar slated for production this year. That was going to involve custom packaging from China and 24 different spices from all around the world. We scrapped that project immediately, just as an example.
And these tariffs have made Ethan Frisch face another big change that's hard to put a number on.
The farmers that we work with everywhere in rural areas in Vietnam and Guatemala and Tanzania, they understand that the U.S. is a great destination for their crops, but also the personal pride that goes into knowing that this product is going to American consumers who will appreciate it.
Do you think this changes what America represents to them now?
100%. It has already changed what America represents to them. I think America was framed as a positive trading partner, and I think the trust that underpinned that is significantly eroded already.
Well, growing exotic spices in the U.S. might be impossible, but shrimp swim in American waters.
My name is Craig Reeves. I'm in Buford, South Carolina, and I'm a lifelong commercial shrimper.
So is his dad, and the trend lines have been clear for decades.
I'm 54, so for my life, it's been a trend down. And, you know, the last 20 years has been in a steep decline.
His wild-caught shrimp just can't compete on price with the farm-raised shrimp from countries like India and Vietnam. So last week, when Trump first announced tariffs of 26% on India, 46% on Vietnam, and more, Reeves was overjoyed.
Ecstatic, you know, overwhelmed that somebody's finally standing up against unfair trade practices.
And yesterday, when he said for 90 days, tariffs on every country but China would be frozen at 10%, that's a lot lower than what you were expecting just last week.
So I've tried to consistently say since the very beginning that tariffs is not, it's a short-term gain, it's a short-term help. You know, my hope is not in 50% or 100% tariffs or whatever's negotiated if it's 10% tariffs. My goal is that the consumer gets to choose whether they buy domestic shrimp or imported shrimp. Instead of being a consuming nation, we need to be a producing nation.
You're 54, so it's safe to say you've got more working years behind you than you have ahead of you. What is your hope for where the industry will be by the time you retire?
Wow. I'm at a stage in my life where I really want to leave a legacy for my children and grandchildren, for them to have an opportunity to make a living from the sea. And that's at risk right now.
Like every American business owner right now, in choppy waters, he's just trying to figure out how to stay afloat.
This is NPR News. Colon cancer is on the rise among young adults in the U.S. New research finds regular exercise can help survivors live longer, in some cases, even longer than people who haven't had colon cancer. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
When it comes to colon cancer, the good news is that overall, death rates have been falling thanks to improvements in screening and treatment. But survivors still tend to have a shorter life expectancy, in large part because of the risk that the cancer will come back.
You can imagine that if patients unfortunately recur, that certainly could affect their survival.
That's Dr. Jeff Meyerhart, a gastrointestinal medical oncologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He says researchers have long known that exercise can improve survival rates in colon cancer patients.
Studies over the years have actually shown that those who were more physically active seem to have a lower risk of recurrence and improvement in overall survival compared to those who were less physically active.
Meyerhart and his colleagues wanted to know if regular physical activity could actually help patients improve their survival rates compared to those who'd never had cancer. So they surveyed nearly 3,000 colon cancer patients about their exercise habits during and after treatment. They found for patients who were 3 years cancer-free, exercise made a big difference.
They actually looked like they had a slightly better overall survival compared to the general population.
Even patients whose cancer recurred had longer survival rates if they exercised the equivalent of walking about an hour a day at a 2 to 3 mile per hour pace on most days. Catherine Schmitz is an exercise oncology researcher at the University of Pittsburgh. She's a firm proponent of the power of exercise both to reduce the risk of dying from colon cancer and to prevent it in the first place.
I know of nothing else that is within the patient's control that is more powerful for reducing cancer mortality, particularly colon cancer mortality, than physical activity.
Researchers are still trying to determine why exercise helps, but evidence suggests that physical activity triggers a series of chemical reactions in cells that promote health in multiple ways.
What you might think of is that all of our cells are bathed in a soup of sorts, and the constituents of that soup change as a result of being more physically active.
She says when you're sedentary, your immune system doesn't work as well, and your cells are more prone to inflammation, which can cause cells to mutate. But when you exercise on a regular basis,
your inflammation goes down, your immune function is better, and the soup in which your cells are bathed is healthier in a way that will tamp down any cancer development or cancer progression.
And at a time when colon cancer rates are rising among people under 50, it's more important than ever to get the word out about exercise. Here's Dr. Kimmy Eng. She's director of the Young Onset Colorectal Cancer Center at Dana-Farber.
We do think that exercise starting in childhood and adolescence also seems to be very important for protecting against the future risk of developing colorectal cancer as an adult.
It's just one more reason why it's crucial to build time for exercise into your daily routine. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Northeast U.S. is going to need a lot more electricity in the coming decades, and many states are counting on offshore wind to help provide it. The Biden administration did a lot to support the industry as part of its effort to boost renewables and tackle climate change. But President Trump deeply opposes offshore wind. He campaigned on shutting it down. From member station WBUR, Miriam Wasser reports on what this means for cities and states that have invested in it.
New London, Connecticut is an old New England port city. Mayor Michael Passero jokes that its heyday was 200 years ago in a very different economy.
Ever since the whaling industry, it's been downhill for the city of New London.
Passero has been the mayor for the last decade. And walking through the downtown area, he points out how things are starting to change.
This is brand new, the Diamond Pizza, really nice place.
There are new stores, apartments, and the city is building a 60,000 square foot recreation center.
Just in the last 5 or 6 years, we have put buildings on lots that have been empty for 50 years.
Local officials attribute the renaissance to two things: growth in the submarine industry and the arrival of offshore wind. Paul Weitzcarver is the chairman of the board of the Connecticut Port Authority. He says New London is well positioned for offshore wind.
It's perfect because not only is it a deep water port, but it's unobstructed.
He shows off the centerpiece of the local industry, a new $300 million pier where turbines are partially put together and loaded onto boats. Behind him, a large crane stacks enormous steel cylinders. People in the community are excited to be part of a new industry, he says. Plus, the construction is just kind of cool to watch.
People come in and they go, wow, what is going on in New London? It's a visual tourist trap, if you want to put it that way.
Between rebuilding the pier and staging two wind farms there, offshore wind has created hundreds of jobs in the area and generated millions for the city and local economy. The question, though, is whether it will last. President Trump has railed against offshore wind for years. He says turbines are ugly and hurt property values. He's also claimed the industry kills whales, though scientists say there's no evidence of that. Since taking office, he's paused all permitting for new offshore wind farms and ordered federal agencies to look at potential environmental and economic harms. Chris Olith leads the Special Initiative on Offshore Wind, an independent think tank that supports the industry. She says the last few months have been tumultuous.
There is a high degree of uncertainty and a high degree of chaos that is leading to real challenges and backsliding for the sector.
Several wind developers in the Northeast have delayed or stepped back from projects, and plans for other wind ports, like the one in New London, are up in the air. Still, some are cheering this slowdown in offshore wind. Diana Furchtgott-Roth is an economist with the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank.
I feel a lot of compassion for people who thought that they were going to have an industry, but I don't think that it's a wise use of tax dollars.
Furchtgott-Roth opposes the big tax credits for wind developers that were established under the Biden administration. She says the Northeast should meet its growing electricity demands by building more pipelines to bring in natural gas from other parts of the country. But many energy analysts say that's unlikely to happen.
We're not going to be building new pipelines into New England.
Dennis Wamsted is with the nonpartisan Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
I mean, nothing's impossible, but it would be very controversial. And we don't have to. We have this resource waiting offshore.
He says many Northeast states have made it nearly impossible to build new pipelines because they want more renewable energy instead. They see wind and solar as a way to create a lot of electricity while also satisfying their climate goals and driving economic growth. And Wamsted points out that New England doesn't have a local source of gas or oil, but what it does have are some of the best conditions for offshore wind in the world.
If you look at it that way, offshore wind makes a boatload of sense, no pun intended.
New London Mayor Passero says it'd be a real loss for the city and the region if the offshore wind industry dried up for good. But he doesn't see that happening.
I'm optimistic that this is just a hiccup. And I also don't believe that we have an energy future in this country unless we harness the offshore wind.
Right now, the New London Pier is booked by offshore wind developers for the next few years. Whether those projects are able to move forward and whether new projects come up behind it, well, the mayor certainly has his fingers crossed. For NPR News, I'm Miriam Wasser in New London, Connecticut.
Thank you.
Police in the Dominican Republic's capital city of Santo Domingo are no longer searching for survivors following a deadly roof collapse at a popular nightclub this past Monday night. So far, authorities say 221 people are dead, with at least 200 people injured. Among those who died were two former Major League Baseball players, a local politician, and some of the island's business leaders. As NPR's Felix Contreras reports, they were all there for a concert by the popular Dominican vocalist Ruby Perez, who also died in that accident.
The hundreds of people who attended the Monday night performance at the Jet Set nightclub in downtown Santo Domingo were there to dance merengue, as performed by one of the genre's biggest stars. Ruby Perez got his start in the early 1980s, singing with merengue band leader Wilfrido Vargas, one of the Dominican musicians who is credited with taking the popular local folk tradition to international audiences. Perez released his first solo album in 1986, and it was called Buscando Tus Besos, Searching for Your Kisses. Desnuda canta la mañana. Merengue has a powerful connection to Dominican identity. During the U.S. occupation of the island in the early 20th century, Dominican insurgents used the music as a symbol of cultural identity and resistance by the largely black population. During the 1960s, Dominican immigration to the U.S., principally New York City, spread the popularity of the music off of the island through artists like Johnny Ventura and Juan Luis Guerra. Ruby Perez became a major star on the island with a career that spanned many albums and decades.
En República Dominicana colapsó el techo de la discoteca más famosa de Santo Domingo.
Spanish language media reports described the Jet Set nightclub as iconic, a venue that could hold over 1,000 people and kept merengue traditions alive. Monday night, the death toll included two Dominican former Major League Baseball players, Octavio Dotel, who was 51, and Tony Blanco, who was 44. Authorities are trying to determine just how many people were in the nightclub at the time of the accident to establish how many are still missing. In the meantime, Ruby Perez's manager has said the body of the singer, who was 69 years old, will lay in the country's National Theater for a public wake and memorial, giving grieving merengue fans an opportunity to say goodbye to one of their own. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
Duele tanto partir, me parte el alma dejarte así, pero este adiós no es para siempre, volveré solo por ti, volveré, porque te amo y tú lo sabes bien, volveré.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the John...
Donna, is anyone finer in the state of Carolina? If there is, then you know her, sure to me, Donna. With those Dixie eyes blazing, how I long to sit and gaze him to the eyes of Dinah D. Every night, why do I shake with pride? Because my dynamite changed her mind about me. Oh, Dinah, since you wanted to China, I would hop an ocean liner just to be with Dinah D. Swinging on out to Jackson, yeah.